Thank you, Mark. Thanks for the opportunity here. I know how many of you just came from Scott Spidell's talk on cow fertility? Just a few.
Okay.
My objectives here are to introduce you to the new work that a bunch of us have been doing, and I'll acknowledge my coworkers on this at the end of the talk, but there's a lot of people, a large team involved in this. I want to start by reviewing what the predictions, previous predictions of cow fertility have been. You know, the cow fertility, we'll talk about, it turns out to be pretty important in any maternal selection index. Talk about our modified approach, which is based on work done by Jim Rozic and others up in Canada, published in 2014, pretty clever way to tackle this problem in a real sensible kind of common sense way that maximizes, I think, the value of the data and still allows us to execute these models in ways that achieve goals like, can we turn this thing in just a few hours, and can we include genomic information easily, and can it fit all animal effects and use all data? Scott spoke extensively about what this new method is. I want to talk about its implementation in our genomic analysis. We have a version of single step that's called the hybrid marker effects model. It's done a little differently than what you just saw. And I want to talk specifically in detail about the American Hereford Association implementation. It's a little different than we've been talking about stability for a long time now, and now we've changed it with the Hereford data, and I kind of wish we could go back and change now what we're doing with IGS. But that one's already out in production now, and it's still a very solid one. But I like what we've done with the Hereford data set now. And then I'll also talk a little bit about the IGS implementation and how it differs. So why cow fertility? Cow fertility trait tends to be lowly heritable, and everyone always complains about that. Oh, you can't make any progress in fertility of cows after they have their first calf. I remember Larry Cundiff said to me once a long time ago, for those of you who know Larry, he's always been really pragmatic. He said, I'm paraphrasing, I'm no longer concerned about traits that are lowly heritable. The key to making genetic progress isn't so much the heritability. The heritability impacts the accuracy of the prediction. But if you can achieve accuracy, and there's several different ways we can achieve accuracy in genetic predictions, then you know, as a lowly heritable trait doesn't matter if you can get the accuracy up. Well, part of achieving accuracy, especially on young animals, is trying to get lots of observations in early on these animals. Another part of achieving accuracy is using genomic information on young animals, and I'll show you some things about what that does. We can get these accuracies up now with this new method and using these new tools to levels that really impact selection indexes, and you'll see that As an ERT, an economically relevant trait in a maternal selection index, often stability or female fertility is really the major driver, the major contributor to variance in that selection index. Relatively small changes, too, in female fertility can translate into relatively large differences in product that a commercial cattleman sells. And this is, not only do they sell more calves, they have fewer costs of replacement heifers and even more calves to sell, more replacement heifers. And then also, everyone kind of forgets about this, you get heavier weaning weights, phenotypic weaning weights out of older cows. And so the more older cows that you can keep, that can push the weaning weights up and have more sale weight, and you have less calving difficulties. So there's lots of drivers behind why cow fertility really is a major, major, if not the major, driver in a maternal index. Make sense? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So we've historically had all kinds of things, probably the most popular things that people have worked on, both in dairy and in beef, are things like days to calving and calving interval. And I don't really, I don't call those ERTs. Those are more indicator traits to me. But we can, we can debate the merit of those. But the real trait is how many calves do you get? And that's what we're trying to predict here with these sustained cow fertility. And how long do you get them out of her? You know, how long does it take her to get them? There is cow longevity. People have done these complex proportional hazards model. Even Hereford had an initial sustained cow fertility for several years that was done with one of these more complex kind of models. They tend to be very difficult to implement in animal models, and they tend to be difficult to implement with marker genomic data. And they tend not to really have an advantage. I think Jamrozek and others have shown that often the random regression approach that we're going to show you here is as good, if not slightly better, than a more sophisticated, more theoretically correct model in actual prediction. I was involved with Warren Snelling's initial work that was published in 1995 in Stayability, which was another type of a threshold model approach to do cows make it to 6 years of age. And since that initial work and Red Angus and others' publication of Stayability, the probability of a cow calving every year up to the age of six, they've modified that. There's other publications, including Brigham and others, about how they've modified it to try and include more data, get the accuracy up early on these predictions. All of those are complex, a little bit ad hoc, but they were steps in the right directions. But then I really think there was, at least in my mind, when Scott Spidell brought to me the Jamrozek paper, which was prototyped initially with the Canadian Simmental data, I think that was a real kind of breakthrough, at least in my mind, for this. So we've implemented it now, tested and implemented it in a couple of breeds. It involves this random regression stayability kind of model where the cows are still observed 0, 1, or missing, and I'll talk about that here in a second, unknown. It might be a donor cow, for example. You use all the data at virtually all ages. Jamrozek stopped at age 9. In Herefords, we've gone to age 12, age 9, and age 12. There's not many additional observations. So the EPDs, whether you cut it off at age 9 or age 12 for the last calving, they're the same. That doesn't matter. But, it's kind of nice to be able to do. And there's some old cows in that Hereford data set. Some of those cows stay around a long time. Like there's a 27-year-old cow that has been verified to have had a calf every year. Is Jack in here? Jack's not here. I checked. She's real. Anybody here have a cow that calved every year to 27? That's amazing. In general, our model, I'll come back to that point. Our model is based on what Jamrozek developed in this paper, and he did a really nice job. It's one of the best papers I've read in a long time, and I've talked with him quite a bit about it. We include in the model, we account for the year of birth, the age at first calving, all these kind of fixed effects. We fit contemporary group, and we've got a specific definition for contemporary group that mirrors what he did. But we fit it as a random effect, so the animal breeders in the room, this is the technical committee, right, Mark? We're allowed to be a little technical. We fit it as a random effect, and in ours, we're fitting two-degree polynomials, and that means we fit for the age of cow, an intercept value, and a slope for every one of the random effects. So contemporary group has the age of cow, intercept, and slope effect. And we fit a random permanent environment due to the dam, we fit these with heterogeneous variants in them. And that is also got, because the dam gets repeated observations, if you're a 12-year-old cow and you've had a calf every year, you get 12 calves. We also fit then the random genetic marker effect. in this use for both an intercept and a slope. So two effects for every SNP marker in the model. And we fit those as animals who are genotyped. So this is the hybrid model is a little different than the other single-step GBLUP approach. We fit actual marker effects, which has an advantage I'll talk to you about in a minute. And we fit then for non-genotyped their marker effects, which are imputed or estimated from their genotyped relatives. And then we fit an effect called the extra polygenic effect, and we fit both an intercept and a slope for that. That is an effect that is genetic. We know it's heritable. We know it's part of the EPD, but given our markers provide only incomplete information about what the genetic makeup is of the individual, that's the part that's the markers cannot account for. So these are pretty big models. I mean, there's a lot going on here. You know, we're talking millions of animals you've got to fit and tens of thousands of markers, and there's a lot of moving parts in here. All right, let's deal with the American Herford Association. So we've decided, at least I think so far, I don't think they've locked it in stone, but hopefully this summer they will. They're not going to call it stability because it's to age 12. Probability of having, or you could do count, number of calves, probability of having a calf every year starting from 3, given you've had a first calf, every year up through the age of 12. And it's not the probability of having it. It's EPDs are differences in probability of having, of achieving that, right? Or you could call it what is the number of calves that this sire's daughters is going to have if she makes it to 12. So we're using this one, observations from 3 to 12. The difference being in traditional stability, it's to 6. Now, you can take any one of these, use all the data, and predict any age along that trajectory. You could take this and easily convert it to a 6-year-old. But I kind of like the 12. And if I had it to do over again, I'd change the IGS one back. But we've determined the correlations between 6 and 12 in these two, and the Herford was 0.92 or something of the EPD. So it makes a difference, but not a huge difference. Also, another decision we made was to use data, and again, this is so far, they haven't locked this in, but right now everyone's leaning this way. Their whole herd reporting program began January 1, 2001. So we use data, actually, we go back a year, so we start of January 1 of 2000. We use observations only from there forward. It makes a big difference. So whole herd reporting is really essential to quality predictions of female fertility. You want to know when a cow really stops and fails to breed, and you want to know why. Is it just because she was a donor cow given a rest, or did she really fail to breed? And the whole herd reporting data at Herford is you know, since 2001, it's pretty stout. Let's see, what do we have? We have 1.1 million animals in the pedigree, about 900,000 phenotypes out of 272,000 females in that set. We fit this for the animal breeders in there. If you look at Jim Rozek, he recommended a 5-degree polynomial or 4-degree, intercept and a couple of terms in the polynomial with a Legendre transformation. Well, we did that initially, and we could get it to converge, nice PCG solve with all those marker effects and all the crazy extra polygenic effects, no problem. But then we are samplers. Theta Solutions. We believe everything should be have a sample, and we like Gibbs sampling, and we like base C with a pi on the, and the reason we like it is because it gives a really high quality estimate of the accuracy of what the prediction is. Really high quality. You're estimating it, but it doesn't have this approximation bias. You know, as long as you believe your model. And when we sampled those more complex models with the genomic information, we had mixing problems. The animal breeders will know what I'm talking about. Failed, the thing just kind of oscillated around, and we went backed up, and we checked quadratic, and we checked linear. Linear behaves really well. The correlations are 0.98 to the cubic. But what happens is I should have drawn it, as cows get older, it basically drops linearly, the scores drop linearly, and then just go flat from there. So it's really a step function. So what we did was we took the best models came out, where we took everything older than 5 years out of a cow and called it a repeat observation at five years of age. And that turned out to be, so up 5 to 12 are all 5. 27,000 genotyped animals in this analysis, in the IGS analysis. You'll see there's quite a few more. Additive genetic effects. We solve all this stuff, and then we crunch it together into a single number. Here's a little picture of what the distribution of observations at different ages are. And you can see, as I said, Jim Rozek said, use up through 9. We're using up through 12. You can see there's really very relatively few observations after the age of 9 here. Here's what the EPDs look like, the SCF EPDs. I've blocked out to hopefully specific registration numbers here. We haven't released any of these, and these aren't base adjusted, so if you figure out who they are, the EPDs could change by the time they get published. But they look very much like the stability EPDs. These are on a probability scale. Our highest accuracy is only 0.8. Now, that isn't because this is a less accurate method. It's because when you stop the approximation bias and accuracy, you tend to, the true prediction error variance is actually usually higher than what we estimate using our approximation methods. And so these are much closer to the true accuracy values, and they tend to go down here. But, you know, you can still get accuracy up there pretty well on these things. So here's what the EPDs look like. And notice we're also, one thing I want to point out to you, just keep this on everyone's mind. We're using international animal IDs, and this is kind of an aside. In all our data now, especially in the IGS data, it becomes really important that we have and know the international animal IDs on these animals, because we're joining data from disparate data sets. But even within something like Hereford, trying to get the genomic information, especially aligned with the performance and pedigree data, is very challenging, and the key to it is converting everything to international IDs. And an international ID starts with the breed code, and it doesn't mean that this animal is necessarily a Hereford USA, although these are, but say in Sim USA, there's some very low percentage Simmental animals that still have Sim USA, and that just means that's the registry they're from. The sex code, and then some sort of number that is either the registration number if it's a registered animal, or some sort of unique code if it's a commercial or non-registered animal. And this is what helps keep data aligned between and within breed. So international IDs, so, you know, start to get used to the notion you're going to start seeing them, I think, quite a bit more. Excuse me. Okay, so here's what the Hereford genetic trend looks like right now. Again, it's not base adjusted. So we'll see where it goes. But you can see, and I believe it, and this is a relatively lowly heritable trait, but it really looks, and it follows their phenotypic trend pretty well. It really looks like they are making good progress on average here, that they're getting more sires, producing more long-lived daughters in their breed. So we fit these marker effects models. And this slide shows you, I guess I can't take that, shows you on the bottom, just starting from the far left, the first chromosome, changing to blue is the second chromosome, third chromosome changes back to red. And these are of the 50K genotypes, and only about 43,000, 42,000 survived our filtering and were actually fit in this analysis. what the effects are on at each marker, or at least what the sampled effects are. What these are is the posterior mean from a Bayes C with a starting value for pi of 0.95 and a partitioning value on the extra polygenic effect of 50%, the prior on it of 50%. And this looks a little unusual, and we've started to see this as we start getting more and more genotyped animals on these samplers, especially Bayes C, tends to start moving these marker effects. There's still plenty of markers with no effect here. I mean, don't get me wrong, but it starts moving these marker effects away from zero. They're regressed less heavily. They are random effects here, after all. And you can see, actually, toward the top of this plot, there's several QTL. And Matt Spangler, I think he's still next door, he's also done a separate study looking at QTL, and we've also looked at this on the IGS data and on individual data sets within IGS. This is for Herford. We're finding QTL in the same location between breeds. Specifically, we both have confirmed QTL at chromosome 28, but not so much in the Herefords. It doesn't express nearly as much, but in the Simmental, it's large, and he's seen that one too. We've seen a couple others at 6, I think, and other places. Big ones, the big ones. Really interesting. It's I'm a believer now. I'm starting to believe it. All these other ones, yeah, there's a lot of noise. We do this thing called window variance. So what happens in this one where you fit all 50,000, 42,000, whatever, loci, a lot of the loci, they aren't, basically none of these are the actual QTL. I don't know, Jerry, are some of these the actual QTL? None of them are. Yeah. They flank around it. They may be actually pretty far from it. But they pick up the signal because of linkage. They're linked to it. And so in different samples, as we sample these things and look at them different ways in this Bayes C sampler, sometimes one loci will pick up the signal of that effect, and sometimes another one will pick it up just as a nature of the thing. And then at the end of it, the average of these markers around the loci kind of average the signal out. So one of the tricks you do to do a little signal noise reduction is window variance here. And so this is just one of the plots of, we do this different ways and look at the window variance on these differently. But this is one of the plots of 1 megabase windows, just all the loci, the SNPs within a 1 megabase, and then are in a window, and then on and on. And we've done, you know, different ways to look at this. This is a good way to look at it, and that gets a lot of the noise out, and it resolves some of the markers quite a bit better. But really, you know, with these methods, these Bayes C and Bayes B methods, the right way to determine if you've got real signal is this mess. And what this is along the bottom are the windows, the same windows in the top, and the colors mean the same thing, the change from chromosome to chromosome. And the vertical axis is the posterior probability of entering the model. In other words, we sample these things 50,000 times. We calculate the marker effect 50,000 times, and at the end we average it out. Well, in this Bayes C with a pi set to some value like 0.95, these markers either enter the model in any one sample or they don't, all right? The analysis says, no, this marker isn't having an effect in this sample, but in the next sample, it might have. And so the frequency of how often the marker has an effect is a measure of how likely that marker is to truly have an effect in these sampled values. So the ones along the top line are actually entering the model 100% of the time, that you can have a great deal of confidence that loci is linked to some sort of QTL here. And what surprises me is how many of these markers in only, what is this, less than 30,000 genotyped animals, how many of these markers stay in the model constantly. And this is a nice, clean, purebred data set here. good solid signal. So we can pick these out, and we do that. We actually, in our production mode runs, then we sample the whole set, and then on our weekly runs, we just use the subset, refreshing that subset at periodic intervals, and the accuracy of the calculation is within a percent to do it that way, but it allows us to turn the EPDs much faster. So that's Herford's, and we're seeing the same kind of thing in the ASA data set. It's quite a bit larger. It's 11 million animals in the pedigree, 3.3 million calving records out of 1.3 million females in that data set. Now, this is a multi-breed data set, and so one of the reasons why I'm not showing you a lot of stuff here is because we're still trying to figure out the multi-breed meaning of this stuff. The observations are 3 years of age to 6 years of age, and we have 79,000 genotyped animals in this, so quite a bit larger data set than that one. So kind of in summary, the advantages here of the random regression approach really is... It really is a breakthrough. For a long time, we've all criticized the standard stayability computations as being pretty crude, and they were. I mean, you know, that was the best we could do. This, I think, really refines that a lot. It uses observations, most importantly, in a much more sensible way. It's simultaneous solutions to all ages. So, for example, the most recent stayability runs done at Colorado State don't do that. They have this kind of ad hoc way of indexing them together. But the problem with that is you can't use every observation at every age. Censoring from culling, so after the zero and if the animal is culled, you don't know if she would have succeeded or not. So we call that a missing value. It doesn't hurt, it doesn't help, it's a missing value. It handles missing values generally then in more sensible ways. And specifically, an example of that is donor cows. Instead of calling a donor cow as either a success or a failure, you just say, don't give her an observation for that age. You know, her observations are basically predicted by what her relatives are doing. It's very easy to implement this in an animal model. Which wasn't true for the hazard function models. Not too bad for the maximum a priori models, the threshold models. But you don't have this Newton's method iteration. Animal breeders know what I'm talking about, where you have to resolve and resolve and resolve, and which really interferes with your ability to get these things done in a timely fashion. Once, especially considering if you have genomic information in here. That really is a big advantage. It is easy to implement the genomic information, too. Nothing special goes on here. You just do a random regression. We've tested that thoroughly, and it behaves well. So it's just generally faster to obtain answers. We can churn analyses easily inside of a day, inside of an 8-hour day. Well, right now I think on the Simmental it's up to 12 hours for a complete end-to-end, and that's mostly done in the sampling step. You can get the EPDs really fast. It speeds up both the PCG solver and the Gibbs sampler quite a bit beyond having to implement Newton's method. And often as good or better, according to the theory, no, to the research, not the theory, often as good or better than the more theoretically correct models. And I'm convinced of that now. I used to not be that way. I used to say, no, you had to do a map or a hazard function. And you can use all data to make a prediction at any age, which is a big advantage here, I think. I'd like to acknowledge my coworkers in this effort. I've done a lot of the programming, but there's been a lot of people involved in looking at these things. We've had groups within breed associations giving these the smell test. We've turned out prototypes and looking at them. We continue to do that in the Hereford. But the people at AHA have been essential and extremely helpful. The people at ASA have been fantastic to work with on this effort. ABRI and the folks there, it's been a real collaborative effort on AHA. They're the ones really helping put this together. And the team at Theta, Dorian and Daniel are great. And Scott Spidel, he's been a real good collaborator on this. And so just I want you to know there's a big team on this, putting this together. Questions?